The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Great to have you here. And we're very excited to have two presenters with us with a very strong Philadelphia history. And it's my pleasure this afternoon to introduce Larry Platt, who will be interviewing Steve Lopez. And Larry Platt has been with Philadelphia Magazine for over 10 years. He became editor-in-chief in 2002. And in addition to Philadelphia Magazine, his work has also appeared in GQ, New York Times, Men's Journal, Playboy, and Salon.com. Also an author, his first book was Keeping It Real, A Turbulent Season at the Crossroads with the NBA, and his most recent book is Only the Strong Survive, The Odyssey of Allen Iverson. Larry's a frequent commentator on NPR and has appeared on Nightline, ESPN, and HBO Real Sports. Please join me in welcoming Larry Platt and Steve Lopez.
Thank you. I'm Larry Platt from Philadelphia Magazine, and I'm joined by a man who needs no introduction to Philadelphians, especially anyone who's ever held public office in Philadelphia, Steve Lopez. And I have to say Steve Lopez, soon to be played by Robert Downey Jr. in a major motion picture, but I have to say that I dearly miss with my morning coffee Lopez skewering someone in Philadelphia. And we're going to talk about the book for 20 or 30 minutes, then open up to questions, and there'll be a signing afterwards. Before we get to the book, Steve, do you follow the Fumo Chronicles any longer?
I had a plane ticket. I was moving back when that thing heated up, you know. I haven't followed it too closely. I know a little bit about it. What's the deal? His trial still coming up?
139 counts. It's in September.
I hope that's a record. Is that a record?
there is certain nervousness that none of it will stick because Vince is a magician. So.
And he's lawyered up, I'm sure. He's got the best, right?
Well, he had Dick Sprague, but now there's a feud. The soap opera just continues.
But doesn't Vince know the judge, I'm sure?
Steve hasn't lived here in 10 years, but you can see he knows the ins and outs. Well, let's talk about The Soloist, A Lost Dream, An Unlikely Friendship, and the Redemptive Power of Music. Steve, you're a columnist now for the Los Angeles Times, and one day you're looking for a column, and you're around Skid Row. And what happens?
It's not just one day I'm looking for a column. It's every minute of every day. What next? You're feeding this hungry monster. And, you know, they're always in a panic. It's not that there's no material in Los Angeles. There's plenty to work with. In fact, I remember having a conversation with Buzz Bissinger about this, and I said, I'm not sure what I'm going to write about out there. I'm not going to have a Philadelphia City Council. And he said, look, you got all these other characters out there. You got, like, David Geffen. And, you know, you start going down the list. And he said, that's your City Council. And there has been. I've been lucky since I've been out there. It went from, you know, September 11th, lots of columns around that, and then the march to war, and then the Catholic Church scandal, and we had a big one in Los Angeles, second to none. I think maybe ours was even better than the one involving, what was it, Bernard Law? And you hear me saying better You're thinking, isn't that a strange way to describe a molestation scandal? But again, I'm a columnist, and I get down on my knees every night and thank the Lord for the likes of Cardinal Roger Mahoney. It's easy material. It's always right there. It's like batting practice. I do pray that the Pope keeps him there. So, and then I have an action hero running against the governor. And I'm thinking, this isn't bad. I can work with this. And, you know, also, though, you can just walk down the street and spot something, whatever city you're in. So one day I'm in downtown Los Angeles, and I had actually gone to check out another column possibility. Every time it rains in Los Angeles, the subway escalators stop working. And this is a city where we would like to encourage people to consider public transportation. So it's not a good thing that they break down all the time. And it's always associated with rain. All you need is a forecast of rain, and the escalators stop. So I was overlooking at the ones downtown. It's a place called Pershing Square to see why they were stopped and who had the repair contract and which L.A.-based Vince Fumo character they knew. And while I was doing that, you see, it's the same. You take the same bag of tricks to every city. And when people find out you really have nothing to say, you have to move to another city. The L.A. Times is my seventh newspaper. I'll be moving in the fall. So I'm over there checking this out, and here I hear music, and I turn, and here's a guy playing a two-string violin. So, and he looks like he's somewhat troubled, standing next to a shopping cart, and all of his belongings are there. And the music's not bad. And I have to admit that my first instinct was not to help him, but to help myself to what looked like a good column. And when there was a break in the action, I went over and asked what the deal was. And he jumped back. He was nervous around me, very wary. And I didn't know how long it might take to get him to loosen up. And I did ask him, though, why he was playing in that particular spot. And he did not have a hat out. He did not have his violin case open. And so he was playing for something other than money. And I said, you know, a violin's got four strings, not two. He said, yeah, I'm aware of that, but the other two wore out, and I don't know how I'm going to get the other two. That's my whole goal in life. And I said, why do you play here? And he points across the street, and he said, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. So at this point, I'm thinking, all right, this could be a column, and it takes several visits. And one day, he's scratching names on the sidewalk. And when I ask who those folks are, he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. So now we've got a column, don't we? And I called Juilliard, and they said, nah, never heard of Nathaniel Anthony Ayres. My heart sank, and I thought maybe he's more delusional than I thought. I didn't know what his condition might be. Next day, Juilliard calls back, and they said, we made a mistake. Yes, indeed. He was at Juilliard in the late 60s, early 70s. So here it was. This chance encounter, this serendipitous moment on the street has led to a three-year relationship between myself and Nathaniel.
And how has that relationship affected both you and him as it's gone along?
Well, I did something early on that I didn't think through too well. When I wrote about him, I was surprised by the response from readers. They responded in, unlike readers have responded to anything I've written, there were hundreds of emails, there were phone calls, there were letters, people sent strings, violin strings, they sent money to buy strings, and they sent instruments. And before long, my desk at the LA Times was surrounded by boxes. And people were going into their attics and closets and digging out instruments that they had not used in years, dusting them off and sending them to me to give to Nathaniel. And quickly, they had a rooting interest in his welfare and in my ability to help him. And so that all surprised me. I didn't think there would be that reaction. I thought maybe the story was a little too dark. But people did very early on see a there but for the grace of God kind of a story. And he was struck down through no fault of his own. And I guess they sensed before I did that this was a story about second chances, human connections, and the power of art and music. They were onto it before I was. So I take these instruments out to Nathaniel, and he thought, he's still trying to figure out, okay, who is this guy who keeps coming out here? And, you know, he was aware that I told him I worked for the LA Times. But he was a little wary of the whole thing, and he says, you know, what's this? It's like an angel, you know, dropped out of the clouds with instruments. And he took them and started to, you know, tune them up and get ready to play them. And I said, you know, I'm going to have to take those back with me. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can't leave you a bunch of instruments. Two of them were new, a new cello and a new violin. I said, you're living out on the street. You stay on Skid Row at night. You're going to be beaten to death for these things. And I can't let that happen. I won't be able to sleep. So let me take them, and I'll leave them at my office. And he was so upset that I said, go ahead and play them for a couple hours. I'll come back and get them. And what I did was I called a mental health agency and told them what I was up against and asked if they would be willing to keep the instruments. If I could talk him into going to the agency to play the instruments whenever he wanted to, then not only would they be safe, but he might make a connection and get whatever help he might need.
And what quickly happened is you were no longer the detached, objective reporter. You're now wrestling with a certain ambivalence about how involved you're going to get in this guy's life.
There are these walls that we build in this business, and you know, it's a little different with a columnist versus, say, a news reporter, but you do want to keep your distance sometimes from the subject, not become a part of the story. And I realized early on that I was on a slippery slope. Here I was getting instruments for the guy and hooking him up with a mental health agency. So it was uncomfortable for me because I'd never done something like that where I got so personally involved. And I didn't know what I should do next, how involved I should get, and I wrestled with what is my role here. Am I his chronicler? Am I his social worker? Am I his friend? And I didn't know quite what to make of the whole thing, and it was a little uncomfortable, but as Larry and I were talking backstage, maybe it's what newspapers should do a little bit more of if they can figure out how to communicate that they're changing and getting more personally involved in crusades. I think that one reason people reacted was because I didn't show that distance in the column that we ordinarily do. It's like I jumped in and said, okay, I'm going to work with this guy and try to help him. And maybe that was such a different thing to see in a newspaper that they related to that a little bit more, and that's why they responded.
Right. I mean, the book is a story about two people. You're a human being in the book instead of this sort of detached observer making pronouncements about this case study.
Yeah. And I just got sucked in deeper and deeper because, well, he went over to that mental health agency after resisting and resisting. And when I got a phone call one day and they said, guess who's putting on a concert in the courtyard at Lamp Community? And I go over and there he is and he's got spectators and there's a woman watching who said that it was just beautiful music and she really related to it. And I thought, okay, that's it. Move on to the next column. We've got this guy cured. He's in the right place, and he's now giving, live concerts. And I left while he was still playing and got a call later, and they said, hey, he tried to leave with the instruments. We caught him at the door. And then a week or so later, he goes back, he plays again, and this time pulls off the heist. He's out the door with the instruments. So I got my buddy Nathaniel on the street with, at the time, I think it was three violins and a cello. And let me tell you about Skid Row. You think you've got a Skid Row here. We've got Skid Row, capital S, capital R. Thousands of people were on the streets back then. Thousands in this area, a few blocks from City Hall. And it was almost impossible to describe. I'd go back to the office and tell my colleagues what I had seen there. And it's not like I'd never seen it. But I never had a vested interest. I had never had anybody I cared about personally who was on those streets. And I'm telling you, there were drug dealers counting cash in the middle of the street, giant wads of cash selling their drugs. You turn a corner and it's like fireflies, crack pipes light up everywhere. People are injecting heroin. People who are obviously seriously mentally ill, who are just sprawled on the street, some people face down in the street. You didn't know if they were dead or alive. Amputees, veterans. And this was where Nathaniel lived at night. And I spent a night with him to see what he was up against and to see if, you know, he was okay with those instruments. He had told me, "Don't worry, Mr. Lopez. If anybody tries to grab these instruments, I will fight to the death to defend them." So, thank you, Nathaniel. That's just what I wanted to hear. So I go out there, and so that's the scene, that first night that I went out there with Nathaniel. He pulls up his shopping cart, and at this point, he had gone several times to the agency, but said he didn't want to live indoors. He didn't want to be cooped up. He didn't trust those people. So he crushes cockroaches with his heel, kicks them into the gutter, starts to put down some of his bedding. This scene is all around us, hundreds of people beginning to bed down for the night. Nathaniel walks over to the curb and recites, as if this is his audience, the Hamlet soliloquy in a Shakespearean accent. And I said, "Where did that come from?" "Oh, we had to take acting at John Hay High School in Cleveland." And he looks up into the windows and he sees lights on and he said, "You know, Beethoven and Mozart were up in windows like that once. They lived and breathed as we do, and they created something that lasted for centuries. Doesn't that inspire you? Do writers inspire you, Mr. Lopez, the way musicians inspire me?" And I didn't even know what to say to him. I mean, he then starts pulling things out of his cart. He had a hubcap to defend himself. It was a shield. He had a club that was a sawed-off leg of a chair. And he pulls these things out. And the last thing he pulled out before going to sleep were two sticks. And on one he'd written Beethoven, and on the other he'd written Brahms. And I said, "Mr. Ayers, what are you going to do with those?" And he said, "When the rats come out of the sewers, I use these sticks on them." And it wasn't too long after that, rats came up out of the sewers, and Mr. Ayers tapped Beethoven and Brahms, and the rats scattered, and he handed me a blanket and said, "I hope you rest well tonight, Mr. Lopez. I hope I hope the whole world rests well." Well, I did not rest well. He went to sleep, and I sat there looking at him, wondering, you know, first of all, how many thousands of stories are there just like that? Not musical prodigies, but just people with a story and a life. Human beings who, through no fault of their own, were struck down and have ended up in a place like that, discarded, shoved into a human landfill. And I became determined at that point to forget all of the rules that a journalist has to abide by and find ways to try to help him. I mean, I felt very deeply affected by what I saw and heard that evening and knew that it would be my mission, not just to write columns about this guy, but to figure out how I could improve his life.
One thing that's important to note is that there are times, owing to his disease, that he is not quite as lucid as this anecdote would seem to suggest, and in fact can be quite mean-spirited and angry and scary.
Yeah, I'm glad you point that out, because I didn't write about the ugly stuff too much in the column because I felt like it was already a tough decision for me to write about him at all in the paper. Here's somebody with a very serious mental illness, and I'm using his name, and I'm writing personal details about him, and I was very conflicted about that, and I was persuaded by the mental health agency people and by his sister, who I got into contact with, and by others, that there was a public service here and that we shouldn't not write about him. Again, he was struck down through no fault of his own, and there is this secrecy associated with this condition. It's like the last subgroup that's in the closet. On a Saturday morning, you don't see a 10K fundraiser for paranoid schizophrenia research. We just don't like to talk about it. And I didn't think that he had anything to hide, and I thought that in telling his story, I would humanize not only him, but thousands just like him, and in the process, help destigmatize mental illness, make it something that we could talk about comfortably, and maybe begin to address a little better than than we have done through the decades, when we, of course, shut down the mental institutions and never followed through on the promise of building the community clinics. So it's taken people like a Sister Mary Scullion to fill that gap, as she did here in Philadelphia. And she... I didn't even realize when I was writing about Sister Mary many years ago, I didn't know the half of what the challenges were and what she had accomplished. I feel naive to have to admit that to you, but it's only through my own experience that I know how much work and passion and compassion went into what Sister Mary accomplished. It's just amazing. And it has served as an inspiration for me. Every time when I would get frustrated with Nathaniel and wanting to give up, I would think about Sister Mary and how steadfast she's been. Because you're right, Larry, it's not all poetry out there. I mean, he can be vulgar and offensive. It comes up instantly, and you can see it in his eyes. You can see the neurotransmitters are kicking, and it's all out of control. And there's rage, and there's paranoia. And it's, you know, everything from racial slurs to death threats. And you never know what you're going to get. The advantage I had with Nathaniel is that he had something going in that has helped sustain him. And I could use it once I learned to speak to him through music. Music is a balancing force in his life. And that's why in the title it's the redemptive power of music. I don't mean... I mean redemptive in the sense of deliverance. It just delivers him to this place of peace. And what I learned about working with Nathaniel is that he sees and hears things all day long, every single day, for 35 years, that I don't see and hear. And his challenge each day is to distinguish between what's real and what's imagined. And that's part of what makes him so disoriented and so angry and so suspicious. And the music, though, is his anchor. He holds a sheet of music in his hands, and the notes have not moved in 200 years. And he holds on to that and then loses himself in the music, whether it's through his violin or his cello or the piano that's now been donated or the upright bass or the trumpet or the harmonica. He wants a flute. He just cannot decide which instrument he wants to play because he loves every instrument and loves all kinds of music. Stevie Wonder's name is carved into his violin. We'll be in the car and he'll start humming the I Love Lucy theme song. So he's lucky he's got the music, but that doesn't mean that it's easy. It's a cruel and persistent disease, and it's been a tremendous challenge to you know, juggle the things in my life because he takes up a lot of time.
When you say you had to learn to sort of speak to him through music, I take it that's, it dawned on me that that's sort of what you were doing when you kind of trick him into getting an apartment or moving into a studio.
Yes,
or...
that's right. That's right. When he resisted, and I didn't understand the psychology or the, I mean, all of this has been a learning experience for me, and I'm certainly no expert, and I'm not a doctor. I'm just trying to be his friend. But it has involved some of a learning, you know, it's been a learning experience for me. And a lot of people will say, well, look, yes, but here's this apartment and the person has chosen to live on the street. So let's just, if that's their choice, let's just leave them there. Well, it's not really a moral choice. It's a choice that's made because there are a lot of issues in the way of getting somebody off the street. And one of the things, one of the advantages to having nothing at all is that you have nothing to lose. And for Nathaniel, being given something was terrifying to him. It meant not only living by the rules of the mental health agency and getting along with people he didn't know when essentially he's antisocial, it meant that he would have an apartment that he might be kicked out of for some reason, something that he might lose. And so he resisted, resisted, resisted. And I was lucky because after I wrote that column about the night on Skid Row and him talking about Mozart and Beethoven, we get a call from the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Would Nathaniel and I like to go to a concert together at Disney Hall? And I asked Nathaniel, and he said, that's very nice of them, but no, I don't think I want to go. Look at me. He said, I don't want people to pay good money to see great music and have to sit next to a character like me. I'm living on the street. I haven't showered in a couple of weeks. I don't want to do that. And I called the orchestra and said, how about a rehearsal? Can we do that? And they said, yeah, come on up. So we go to see Beethoven's Third Symphony. And Nathaniel, my tutor, one of the many gifts I've received in this relationship is I've learned a little bit about music. I was just your average rube who didn't know much about anything. I know jazz. I kept trying to get him to switch to jazz. Every once in a while, he'll do something from Porgy and Bess for me. But then he's back to Dvorak or the Elgar Cello Concerto or something, and I'm lost. I take my guitar out. Another thing he's done for me is I've when he came to our house and played music in our living room, when I saw the way that my daughter Caroline reacted, I was so envious. I mean, to her, it's magic to hear live music 4 feet away from you from a stringed instrument like this. And she just thought this was terrific. So I got my guitar and started playing. And I have a ways to go, but if the song is something like, why are there so many songs about rainbows? Or John Jacob Jinglehammer Schmidt. I've got those down. I'm a three-chord wonder. And I play that stuff for my daughter, and we have fun, and she actually thinks that I know how to play an instrument now. But I've gone out on the street with Nathaniel and played guitar while he's playing. He gets quickly bored with me. And people walking by just do not know what to make of this duo. They look at him, and they think, okay, maybe, yeah. And then they look at me, and you could just see what they're thinking is, he expects money for this. But, you know, I related to him not just through my own playing, because I play in a different language altogether, but I just learned about music and asked him to explain what the music was about. When we go to a concert, and we go now regularly, he's elbowing me, saying, you know, there's going to be some really interesting interplay between the violin and cello sections on this. Be sure to check the first violin and the second cello interplay. And this Third Symphony, of course, is known as the Eroica. It's a tribute to heroism. It was initially a tribute to Napoleon, but, you know, Beethoven had a change of mind about that. Okay, Mr. Ayres, I mean, so we go to this first rehearsal, and we're alone in Disney Hall, which is a spectacular Frank Gehry creation up on the hill in downtown Los Angeles, and we get close, and Nathaniel says, it looks like an iron butterfly. And I said, Nathaniel, I'm coming to see Itzhak Perlman with the National Symphony in a month or so. And he said, oh, Perlman is molten lava on violin. And this is after I'd met him on Skid Row, and nothing that he said made sense. But now we're going up to Disney Hall, and it's like medicine. So we get in front of it, and he runs his hand over the board, and the names Beethoven and Mozart, like they're gods, and we go in, and we're sitting in the front, and when the third is done, Nathaniel goes, bravo! And several musicians came to meet him. They'd been reading about him in the paper, and one of them, a cellist by the name of Peter Snyder, offered to give him lessons. And I asked Peter later if he would mind giving him those lessons in an apartment that was being offered to him by LAMP Community, a mental health agency, because I needed to get him familiar with that room and comfortable in it, and maybe music would make him comfortable, and he'd agree finally to come in off the streets, and that's what did it.
Isn't that great? One of the most moving moments in the book is his meeting with Yo-Yo Ma, who he was at Juilliard with. Can you take us through that?
Yes. Nathaniel was a bass player. He was trained on bass, and he went to Cleveland Public Schools at a time when public schools in America actually had music classes and arts classes before that got stripped away, and everybody played. And he got very good in such a hurry on bass. They needed a bass player. They needed a rhythm section in the junior high band. Nathaniel had his eye on other instruments, and it kind of shoved him off in that corner because he was strong and he'd taken some piano lessons, and his mother ran a beauty salon called Flo's Beauty Parlor at 95th and St. Clair in Cleveland. And he would go there after school and listen to music on the radio, and he got very interested. So he was a kid with a gift and then a real interest in, you know, getting good. So the junior high teacher couldn't help him, so he sends him over to a member of the Cleveland Orchestra, Harry Barnoff, a bass player. And a few years later, Nathaniel realizes that he's good enough, and Barnoff says, if you work really hard, you can get yourself a scholarship to Ohio University. It's a great music program, and I'm going to put in a word for you. And he does. So he goes to Ohio University, but he tells Mr. Barnoff, he said, you know, this is great, and thank you for your help, but Mr. Barnoff, you went to Juilliard. That's my goal. I want to go to Juilliard. And Barnoff said he didn't want to break his heart, but he told him, that is so difficult to do, Nathaniel. It is one of the elite schools of the world. The competition is really stiff, even among bass players. And why don't you slow down, do as well as you can at Ohio University, and think about that later, but just stay put. Nathaniel calls Juilliard and asks for an audition. This is toward the end of his first year at Ohio University. Gets the audition, flies to New York, student standby. Do you remember student standby? Do they still have that?
I don't think so.
So he goes to New York, takes a cab to Juilliard, lugging his upright bass, goes in and nails the audition. And they decide not only that he's good enough, but they're giving him a full scholarship. And can he please pack his bags for the Aspen Summer Music Festival, where he's going to be meeting some of his new classmates and teachers. So he goes there, and it goes okay, and he realizes, God, I suppose I really am going to be a musician. And then goes to Juilliard, and it's things are going really well, and yes, Yo-Yo Ma is one of his classmates. And so all these years later, he is wearing a T-shirt in downtown L.A., and on it he has written Yo-Yo Ma, Steve Lopez, L.A. Times, LAPD, and a concert date at Disney Hall. And I said, Nathaniel, what's up with that? And he said, Yo-Yo Ma is coming to town. Can we get tickets? And I said, can we get tickets? You're a VIP. All we have to do is call and say, Nathaniel wants to see another concert. So we're escorted to our seats when we get to Disney Hall by the publicist, Adam Crane, who's also a cellist and has become one of Nathaniel's dearest friends. Adam escorts us to our seats, and we watch the performance and go backstage. Nathaniel has worn a necktie, his best clothes. He's looking in the mirror as we're backstage waiting for Yo-Yo Ma. And he is very nervous. What's he going to say to Yo-Yo Ma? And Ma comes into the room, walks over, shakes his hand, and says, we are brothers. Anybody who loves music as much as you do, Nathaniel, is a friend of mine, and we are brothers in music. And Nathaniel is just speechless. And Yo-Yo Ma then hands Nathaniel his cello and says, I've got to go meet some other people. I'll be back in a bit. Why don't you fiddle away with this thing for a while? So that was quite an experience that day.
I want to open this up to questions in a minute, but I want to read one thing to you, which is your voice in the book. And I found this scene maddening, and I want to have you walk us through it and comment on it. This is your sort of conclusion at this of this anecdote. The father who walked out on a son who lives for music has been robbed of his hearing, and there has to be a Sunday sermon in that. Can you tell us what that referred to?
Yes, I would. Nathaniel would often mention his father, and in fact, what happened at Juilliard was that in his third year, Nathaniel started to hear voices and had trouble focusing and didn't know who to turn to. He was, as far as I can determine, the only African-American student in the classical program that year. There was Eugene Moy, who was half African-American, and Nathaniel roomed with him. So he was not only having to prove himself as a musician in that elite pressure cooker, but he just felt like he was alone in more ways than one. And when he started hearing things, he had no way to tell what that was about and nobody to turn to. And it happened for about a year, and his grades started to fall. except for the grades in which he was performing. If he had to sit in a classroom, his A's went down to B's and C's and D's. In orchestra, it was all A's because he had the music and he could speak through it and find a level of sanity through it. But finally, at the beginning of his third year, he just crashed and was taken to Bellevue Hospital, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and spent many, many years on the streets of Cleveland and living with his mother, and she did her best with it, and Nathaniel was in and out of shock therapy. Back then it was Thorazine, which, of course, zapped him and zapped his creative instinct, so he has horrible memories of it and doesn't want to hear about medicine, doesn't want to hear that there's a new generation of antipsychotic meds. That's why it's very difficult for me to push him in that direction, and luckily he's got the music. You know, the music is medicine, Disney Hall is his hospital, and the L.A. Orchestra members are his doctors. So we've got that going for him, but what was your question?
The father who walked down on the...
Oh, so. How did he get to L.A.? His mother tried and did her best, and she died, I think, in year 2000. And a year or two later, Nathaniel goes to California to look for the father who had left Cleveland when Nathaniel was 9 or 10. And his father was driving a trash truck in the city of Los Angeles, and Nathaniel thought he was still there. Takes a bus to L.A., discovers his father has already left for a retirement community in Las Vegas, and he's got nobody. He stayed with a relative for a while and then ended up on the streets until the time I met him. And I went to see his father. And his father is in his 80s, and I said, I've met your son, and he is a remarkable human being. He's had a very deep impact on me and in some ways changed my life. And what do you remember of him, and what do you think of his success as a musician, and what do you think of the fact that he ended up on the streets with a two-string violin? And his father told me, he's made his choices in life. And I think that he's out there because he wants to be out there. And I said, it's a little more complicated than that. He has something that's called schizophrenia. Are you familiar with that? He said, I guess they call it that, but I'm not sure what that means. I just think that when he is around me, he's not very happy, so I guess he likes being out on the street better. And that was, I didn't know what more to say to his father. I got on a plane and went back home.
It is heartbreaking, and that's when you write, because his father's hard of hearing, that the father who walked out on a son who lives for music has been robbed of his hearing, and there has to be a Sunday sermon in that. It's a powerful scene. If anyone wants to ask questions, we have a microphone here. We have two microphones. Wait for the microphone, and we can, yes, right down here. It's a race to get to him first. Right behind you.
First, I want to say that Philadelphia has had Joe McGinnis, Pete Dexter, and Steve Lopez. And since you've left, you have not been replaced, and you've been greatly missed.
I appreciate that, but I think there are a lot of great people still working there. And I thought that Tom Ferrick's work was great, among others, and Dan Rubin now. And I was on a beach in the Caribbean not long ago, and we just really needed a break, and it felt so good to be in one of the most remote places in the world. And a family comes walking down the beach toward us, and they got closer, and they looked a little familiar, and then even closer. And I said, David Dye and Karen Heller? And they said, Steve Lopez? But no, I appreciate that, Wraith. I think there are a lot of good people still there, though, and it's a tough time in the newspaper business, but I hope that they can pull through. I've got a lot of friends there.
Okay. My question is, I just saw a movie about a journalist, I think in Denver, who finds a homeless guy on the street who turns out to be a former professional boxer. I think he played by Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
Now, there's that movie. You found this guy who's a former classical musician. Could this possibly be a trend in American journalism?
Three's a trend, so we need one more, right?
Yeah, you know, Wraith, you've done a lot of writing yourself. There are no new stories. There are only new writers and new actors. That actually was based on an L.A. Times story, that story. It's called Resurrecting the Champ. Yeah. And that's a movie that was changed so much from what the story had been that the writer, I understand, was a little bit upset. There have been some changes in my movie, but not so, you know, some were difficult to accept. But I don't know. It's I don't know that there's a trend. But I do feel like the movie... I was involved in picking the producers and have been in consulting with them through the whole process. My hope was to get it as true to reality as possible. But because it's a reduction, as any movie is, it means taking some shortcuts and adding some things for dramatic tension or conflict or whatever else. But I think the movie's going to be pretty good, and I know that everybody associated with it really has their fingers crossed. The director is Joe Wright, who did Atonement, and Robert Downey Jr. plays me, and Jamie Foxx plays Nathaniel. And the four of us went to a concert at Disney Hall, and Jamie Foxx had a tape recorder taking in everything that Nathaniel did, and within a couple of weeks looked like him, talked like him, walked like him. Downey has been fun for me to get to work with, and they both had things in their lives that I think they both had some difficult times, and it allowed them to get into these characters. And everybody is hoping that they've made a really good movie. They're done with the filming, and the editing begins now, and it's supposed to come out November 21st.
Let's get about right there.
Of course, we all miss you. How has your, particularly this story, affected the establishment in Los Angeles vis-a-vis services for the mentally ill and what's gone on over there as a result?
When I got to know Nathaniel and began fearing for his life out on Skid Row, I decided to do a series on Skid Row. And the purpose was to try to capture and convey those things that I had told my colleagues were impossible to describe. And they said, well, why don't you spend 3 weeks out there and then come back and think about it for a week and spend another couple of weeks writing it, and we'll run a series that's in the paper in a few months. And I just thought about all of the editors I would have to sit in meetings with for the next 6 months. And I said, I've got an idea. How about if I, no offense against editors, how about if I just go out every single day, find something, come back, write it, and you put it in the paper the next day? We'll do that for 7 days because then it's raw and emotional, and I don't waste too much time thinking about what, you know, it's just going to be a better way to do it. And they said, go ahead. The second day of that series, I get a call from the mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, and he said, I want to come out there with you. And I didn't want him to come out with me because he travels with an entourage, and it's, you know, it's a little tricky to get people to open up. I mean, you're surrounded by drug dealers and people shooting up heroin and everything else, and I didn't need a three-car caravan. And so I discouraged it, but he came anyway. And he came sort of incognito. It was drizzling, and he had a jacket and a hood pulled up over him. And people didn't know it was the mayor, so he got a close-up look. While I was talking to some guy, he injected heroin into his arm right in front of the mayor. And I didn't know it was the mayor. I was looking over my shoulder to make sure that I was safe because there were some people who were hostile toward me just for being out there. And, you know, I kept thinking I better be careful, I might get a knife in the back. And I felt somebody on my shoulder and turned around to see if I was safe, and it's the mayor. And the mayor was just, you know, jaw dropped, staring at this, not knowing what to do. By the end of the week, it was added to his list of things to fix in Los Angeles. This is an embarrassment. William Bratton said, this is the worst situation in America, and we're going to do something about it. And the mayor later committed $50 million to what's called permanent supportive housing. That's what what Nathaniel lives in. And what that means is that you don't have just a roof over your head, but all of the services you might need, from psychiatric treatment to job training to somebody who's hooking you up with Social Security and finding your long-lost family. It's all under one roof, and it works really well. It's, you know, I don't know if Sister Mary would call what she does permanent supportive housing, but it's like that. New York City does a great job of it. L.A. did a really poor job of it, and we have a huge population. So the mayor said he was going to do that, and then the county supervisors said they were going to do the same. And in California, we approved something called Prop 63, the Mental Health Services Act, which pumps $1 billion a year into new mental health services. So it looked for a while like Nathaniel was the poster child for renewed interest in addressing all of these issues. And there has been some improvement, but the money stopped, and there's still a long way to go. And it's as if now with budget problems throughout the state, they've lost the political will or the funding to do this. I do think, though, that it's possible for change without government intervention and without billions of dollars pumped into permanent supportive housing. It'd be nice if that were there. But my experience with Nathaniel, I think, teaches us something that, and I'm surprised, and I've invited Cardinal Mahoney to get involved in Los Angeles in creating sort of a buddy system. I mean, what does the church stand for? Create a buddy system, make connections in the community, and have people who want to give an hour a week adopt somebody. You know, it doesn't have to be somebody who's really seriously ill, just somebody who's on the streets and needs a friend. And I think that sort of thing could really make a big difference. And there's no organized movement in that direction in Los Angeles. And I would hope that at some point we get something like that.
You know, in terms of one of the things, as you talk about that in a buddy system, you had to be incredibly patient with Nathaniel, though, because I don't know that I would have been able to do it. He's maddening.
That's right? A good word. He is maddening. And I'm not a patient guy. I don't think many newspaper columnists are. You know, you bang it out, you write the column, it's in the paper, you move on to the next subject before anybody realizes you really had no idea what you were talking about. Or you move to another city. And no, I just had to keep working with him. But there are many rewards, and there, you know, he's fun. When he's not a challenge, he's really, really fun, and he's childlike. He wants to do things. He'll call up Mr. Lopez, good morning, 7 a.m. This is Nathaniel Anthony Ayers calling. How is Mr. Stephen Lopez of the Los Angeles Times? Miss Allison, how is little Caroline and Jeffrey and Andrew Lopez? How are all our friends in the L.A. Philharmonic? And I was wondering, if you're free at all, could we go to batting cages somewhere today and hit a few balls? Can we go to a golf range? Could we go to the beach? I'd love to play the trumpet on the beach. Can you get tickets to the Dvorak concert? And so I try to answer these, and some of them are really fun. He called and was insisting on golf. And I don't really play golf. And I said, all right, we'll go to a driving range. So I go and I pick him up, and all I had was a pitching iron and a putter. And I had a pitching iron because I had done a column in which I was with a pitcher from the Los Angeles Dodgers, and we were trying to see who could hit a pitching wedge over the center field fence from home plate, because that's the kind of important journalism that's being done in America today. Don't cancel your newspaper subscription. It was actually a fundraiser, and if Derek Lowe did it first, I had to pay his charity. If I did it first, he had to pay mine. So anyhow, I had this pitching wedge left over, and Derek Lowe won the contest. So I pick him up, and we go to the golf course, the driving range, and Nathaniel dresses colorfully, is a good way to describe it. And this morning in particular, he had on combat boots, military fatigues, a flowered lei, Miami Dolphins baseball cap, turned backwards with sunglasses over it, and a bright green fluorescent vest on which he had, in big block letters, put Skid Row. This is not the kind of outfit that is ordinarily worn to a golf course. So we get out of the car, and we're walking over to the clubhouse, and I'm thinking, we need another club here. We can't hit pitching wedges all day. So I take Mr. Ayers into the clubhouse dressed like this. Every eye in the place is on us. And I look into a tub of demo used clubs, and I see a six iron that says Cleveland on it, which is the brand name. And I show that to him. He assumes it's been made for him because he's from Cleveland. So we buy a six iron and a bucket of balls and go out to the range. And there's like 40 little cubicles there where you hit balls to your heart's content. And there's maybe six or eight golfers scattered around, and I go to the one furthest away from any golfer. And they see Nathaniel and see me and wonder, okay, what are his issues, and what are the issues of the guy with him? And so he's over there setting up, and all the golfers move over to be closer to us. So I don't know what to expect here with Nathaniel, and I assume he's played, you know, before somewhere. And he says, no, Mr. Lopez, never play. And this is great. I said, look, I haven't played that much in a long time, but I'm going to tell you a few things I know about. You keep your head down, you don't overswing, and just take it easy. Okay, got it, Mr. Lopez. So I'm going to stand up now and tell you what followed. Okay, so, Mr. Ayers, it's something like this. You just swing easy and keep your head down. Got it, Mr. Lopez. He's 57. I'm 55. He calls me Mr. Lopez. I call him Mr. Ayers. I tried to get him to call me Steve. It didn't work out. So it's Mr. Ayers and Mr. Lopez at the golf course. And we've now got a bucket of balls for, I don't know, $2. There are 700 balls or so. We put them down in this tray, and I set up the first one on the tee. And Mr. Ayers, who has never played, grabs the club as if maybe he has. After I get the grip right, the right hand on top of the other hand, he does this. Mr. Ayers, there are 700 of these balls. You keep your head down, you keep your eye on the ball, you do not overswing. You don't want to tear the Skid Row vest. Okay, Mr. Lopez. You remember the Honeymooners, Jackie Gleason? I said, Mr. Ayers, hit the ball. And don't overswing. I've got it, Mr. Lopez. His swing is something like this. Both feet come up off the ground. He swings around like this. The club hits the side of the cubicle next to us. The edge of his club caught barely the ball on the tee, which shot like a rocket into the 700 balls, which exploded as if out of a popcorn machine. The balls are flying out onto the range. Line drives are going through there from the other golfers. Mr. Ayers, in combat fatigues and a Skid Row vest, is retrieving balls saying, I'm getting them back, Mr. Lopez. We can hit them all again.
That really ought to be a scene in the movie.
It should be.
But you probably couldn't recapture it. Let's go to the middle here somewhere. Was there a question? Yes, sir, right there. By the way, Steve, there's a mutual friend of ours I want to acknowledge. Zach Bissinger is in the audience.
Hi, Zach.
Hey, Zach. Hey, Zach.
Zach's a good buddy. Zach, you want to go golfing with me and Mr. Harris?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Lopez, I have a question about the services you sought for Nathaniel. If it's a question that addresses your concerns about the services, the eminent psychiatrist philosopher Thomas Szasz says that the array of mental health services available are intrinsically dysfunctional, because they intend both to liberate therapeutically and to control individuals, and that's an inherent contradiction in their nature. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that position as you encounter services.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, as an amateur, I had no idea what to do. And I decided during this whole process with Nathaniel, I had to wrestle with what is my role, and I decided I'm not his doctor, and I'm not the one who should push him toward a doctor. I've just got to be his friend and stay in touch with the people who can make those decisions because they're trained to make them. The problem with that is that you get people in training who disagree about what the proper approach is, and lots of folks who were telling me, you are not ever going to see a change in him without a commitment. He needs to be committed. He needs medication. That's the only thing that is ever going to change him. The mental health agency that he ended up living at has a different philosophy, that if you push, you might lose whatever trust you've built up, and that if your goal is to get him to take medication that's forced on him, first of all, it's a terrifying experience for somebody who's been through what Nathaniel has been through with shock therapy and with Thorazine, handcuffs, straitjackets, prison cells. He thinks that's where he's going if you start pushing. The other thing is that it's not as simple as, oh, now you took a pill and you're okay. So don't think that it's a panacea, and it's difficult to find the right med, then it's difficult to find the right dosage, and then if you happen to get really lucky, you might have the person say, I feel great, why am I taking this stuff? So 2 weeks later, you're out on the street. So a lot of people, their first question to me is, you've been working with him for 3 years, he's on his meds, right? No, he's not on his meds. Well, why not? Because it's a difficult subject, and because I hope that one day he, on his own, with the help of people he trusts, decides that he wants to try it. But I don't expect that when he does, it's necessarily going to cure anything. There's no cure for this. And what he's got that's a really powerful medicine is music. And what I can do as his friend is to keep him medicated with music, to answer those calls when he wants to go to Disney Hall, to fix his violin when the bridge breaks, and to buy him whatever sheet music he wants. And sometimes he wants everything in the store. He wanted a trumpet. We found a trumpet on Craigslist offered by a USC student. We went to buy it, and he said, I need sheet music for this, Mr. Lopez. We went to a store in Santa Monica. He opened every drawer in the store, and we walked out with about $800 worth of sheet music. But again, think about sheet music. Did I say here earlier that when he sees the notes on the page, it's so familiar? And there's not an antipsychotic medicine that can do what music does for him. So we'll see. I don't know where it's headed, but there are different philosophies about how you treat someone like that. And I'm in touch with people who are guiding me through this, and so far they've done pretty well.
We've got time for one more. Is there anyone in the back? No? Way back there. I'm trying to move this around geographically.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lopez. I was very thrilled by your article that you had in the newspaper. That's why I'm here. The part in the article that you wrote, when you mentioned something about something you were trying to get Nathaniel to do, and you mentioned at this moment he's in charge. Have you got many responses on that? Because I've been working with homelessness and people that have mental illness for about 20 years now. And that's the first time I ever seen something expressed like that. So I just wanted to know, have you got many responses like that? And in regards to what you said, he's in charge at that moment because he wasn't ready to do what you wanted him to do.
I think he is in charge. I mean, I haven't gotten to the point in the relationship with him where I can get him to do necessarily what I want him to do. And I'm up against a persistent, really cruel disease, and he's not always thinking logically or rationally, and I just have to accept that as part of the relationship. I do pretty much know that he is in charge. There have been times when I had to take over, when he blows up in public. We went to a Dodger game recently, and on the way up there, he was reading my book aloud, and he called his sister and read some passages to her. And I was very... It's a strange experience to see Nathaniel read the book. He knew that I was writing the book. He knows that a movie is being made, but I worry constantly about how he will process it, how he'll react to the attention. And I know that he had been upset with his first look at the book about something he'd seen, a reference to his mother having to deal with his flare-ups, and he reacted violently. So I was very relieved to see him reading the book and telling me that, you know, this is a tribute, Mr. Lopez, thank you for doing it. We get to Dodger Stadium and we get out of the car, and he says, is it going to rain tonight, Mr. Lopez? And I said, I don't know, Mr. Ayres. And he said, well, I want to bring in some of my music, but I don't want to do that if it's going to rain. Can you tell me if it's going to rain? And I said, there's a forecast, but I can't tell you. He got belligerent. He got really upset. We went in to watch the game, and he stood up and just started ranting. And it became very scary, and he was aggressive and became a bit of a spectacle. So I just said, we are going home, Mr. Ayres. So I took charge then, and we went back, and he didn't speak to me for a week. Another time, not too long ago, he had another issue with the book. I was being interviewed by the New Yorker. The New Yorker is doing a story that actually comes out Monday on the book, the movie, and the movie people's interaction with Skid Row. Many of the people who live with Nathaniel are in the movie, playing themselves, by the dozens and even by the hundreds. You walk down on the set and see 100 people who live on the sidewalk are lined up waiting to film a scene. And the director, Joe Wright, got very personally involved, and he'd hang out for hours at LAMP, and so would some of the actors and the crew and the producers. I mean, they want to get it right, and they wanted to look at this thing close up. And so here's the New Yorker doing this story, and we go to Disney Hall, and Nathaniel is there and wants to get in to see a rehearsal. And we're trying to tell him, this rehearsal is closed, no one's allowed. And he said, well, looked at me and said, I'm not talking to you. And asks the publicist. And the publicist said, well, Mr. Lopez is right. And he said, I don't care what Mr. Lopez says. I want to see the rehearsal. So I let him outside, and you've been through this, I'm sure, where somebody, you don't know what they're going to do or what you should do. We get outside, and I've got Nathaniel on my left screaming at me, and I've got the New Yorker reporter on my right taking notes on what a wonderful rapport I've established with Nathaniel. And he's, you know, I don't ever want to see you in my life again. And you can hear the scribbling. She's determined to get every word down. And he says, and by the way, your book sucks. And I hear that and look over, and your book sucks. Looks like I've got a bad review in the New Yorker, and it's from the man the book's about. But, you know, you've seen this, I'm sure. 2 days later, he's calling me apologizing. And here's where I have hope that Mr. Ayres continues to get better. The philosophy of the people who oversee him daily, call it recovery. It doesn't mean cure, but it means you can get better and recover a life and have a community and have a goal and a purpose. And that's their sense of what recovery is, and I've sort of embraced that. So Nathaniel calls me twice a day, every day for the next 10 days, checking in with me, making sure everything's okay, apologizing for the outburst and explaining why he thought it happened. And that kind of insight and awareness of his own unacceptable behavior is, to me, a huge sign of progress. And it's an encouraging sign as well for the professionals who work with Nathaniel on a daily basis. And if you've been doing this work for 20 years, sir, I just want to thank you, because I know the challenge. I know that you don't do it to get rich. You do it because you care and you think you can make a difference.
And on that note, I want to thank Steve Lopez for this important story. Steve will sign books upstairs for about half an hour, and thank you all for coming. And maybe he'll come back for the FUMO trial.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.